Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There was a time when a formidable Republican presidential candidate was poised for a dominant primary win in his party. He campaigned in a charged political climate, facing an incumbent president in an election with major implications for the future of the country. All of those things can certainly be said about this year's contest, but I'm referring to the one that took place in 1976 when incumbent Gerald Ford narrowly defeated challenger Ronald Reagan for the Republican nomination, only to lose to Democrat Jimmy Carter. It was the closest presidential primary race in American history, and what followed and how it shaped our political parties and opened the rifts that divide us today is the focus of Landslide. It's a podcast produced by award-winning public radio reporter Ben Bradford, who, in interest of full disclosure, worked here not too long ago, and he joins us for the hour. Ben, nice to see you again. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us to take us through this remarkable election year are Dr. David Goldfield and John Dodd. Dr. Goldfield is professor of history at UNC Charlotte, and John Dodd is president emeritus of the Jesse Helms Foundation at Wingate University. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So before we begin this conversation, I should mention that WFAE is a producing partner of this podcast that we'll be talking about this hour, Landslide, along with Ben Bradford and his independent podcast company, Nuance Tales, and you can get it wherever podcasts are sold, or not sold, wherever you get your podcasts. So Ben, let me start with you before we talk about the race in 1976, et cetera, and the men who ran in it. How did WFAE become a producing partner on this podcast, and why?
Yeah, well, Landslide is a national story of a presidential race. And as you mentioned, I've been developing it. I've been doing, since my time at WFAE, and then various political reporting at other public radio stations. And then I was a reporter at Marketplace. And then I began developing these kinds of podcasts. And was looking for a partner on this one, and North Carolina plays a very central role in the narrative, and that's something that we're going to discuss on today's show. But I think that was sort of the natural in for WFAE to participate.
I'm going to wager that you were not alive, or at least not a sentient being, in 1976. So why did this pique your curiosity, and why is now the time to look back on that period of our history?
Yeah, I was not alive. Thank you. And
damn you.
But I have been really interested, as I mentioned. I've covered politics. I covered politics when I was at WFAE. I covered politics in California, covering the state house over there. I had a brief stint before I was a journalist working in politics and got a little inside look there. And I think that, you know, back in 2016, during that election, when I think for a lot of people, the divisions in the country and the degree of divisions between people who sort of identify with one party or the other became just so glaring. And that sort of natural question of, well, where did this come from? How did we get here? That has been really a driving question for me for the last 4 or 5 years. And so this podcast is very much an outcropping of that, where we're looking for roots that led to our political climate today. And as I have done that, I have become more and more interested in the shape of the political parties themselves. So the basic idea is that, you know, we as a country have always been divided, but we have not always been, and it's fairly new for us to be divided, polarized between two parties with a partisan gulf in the center. Usually the parties themselves have been more messy and muddled, two teams rather than two tribes. And so 1976 is a really critical election for creating our current paradigm.
I was alive in 1976 and went to high school, at least before he became president, with President Ford's children. And there are remarkable parallels to what went on there to what is going on today. President Ford, in his brief tenure in office, faced inflationary pressures. He even started a campaign. Everybody was wearing whip inflation now buttons because of rising prices. There was an energy crisis, incredibly long gas lines. Sometimes you would wait in those gas lines, and when you got to the pump, it was empty. What are some of the other similarities that you noticed?
I think that the general feeling, and this is something that we try to capture in the podcast, the general feeling of the climate being fraught, things going wrong, danger in the air, that is very much the feeling at the time. And so I think you mentioned some of the big ones. I mean, you know, this new economic phenomenon is hitting the country called stagflation. For the first time, parents don't think that their children will necessarily have a better life than they do. You're at the very end of the Vietnam War, where most of the American troops, almost all the American troops, are out, but South Vietnam is still barely standing, and that's collapsing. And that says something about American military power and its place in the world abroad. And so I think that there are a lot of questions about what America is and how it compares to sort of the idea of a God-blessed country that people are reckoning with at the time.
So, Dr. Goldfield, Gerald Ford was an unelected president because he was an unelected vice president chosen to fill Spiro Agnew's role in the Nixon administration after Spiro had to resign in disgrace. Then Nixon resigned in disgrace to avoid impeachment, leaving Ford in the Oval Office. And he had to fix everything, which was a gargantuan job. And Ford's job, as I understand it, as he saw it, was to bring the nation together, which is exactly how Joe Biden positioned himself 3.5 years ago as he was running for his first term. Should what happened to Ford in the next election send shivers down the spines of Democrats today?
Of course, because there are some similarities, but there are, in fact, significant differences. One of the major differences, of course, is that Gerald Ford was considerably younger than Joe Biden this year. And I think age is going to play a role in the upcoming presidential campaign, which it did not. But let's go back to the late 1960s. Actually, this crisis that Sam and you have talked about began in the late 1960s with the opposition to the Vietnam War. I remember being on campus at Maryland and marching to the Pentagon in opposition to the war. The country was literally torn apart by the Vietnam War. And then Nixon was elected in 1968, and I refer to Nixon as the last Democratic president with a capital D. What I mean by that, if you look at Nixon's administration, and let's forget about Watergate for the time being, when you look at Nixon's administration, he was really the first real environmental president. That is, the first president that promoted environmental interests. Second, he built more public housing than any of his predecessors combined. Nixon really continued the work of the post-World War II presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and particularly Lyndon B. Johnson. And of course, January 1972, he was involved in the beginning of the Watergate affair, and of course that eventually brought him down. But let's not forget the expansive view of Richard Nixon, not only domestically, but he was the guy who reached out to China.
Yes.
And that was really, really very important. Watergate was a tragedy in the sense that it ruined Nixon's political career, but it also added to the malaise, as Jimmy Carter once called it, the malaise of the country. You had the Vietnam, you had the civil disturbances in the late 1960s, the so-called race riots in the late 1960s. You had the split in generations, young people, very, very different. I was concerned about being drafted, as were millions of my cohorts in the baby boom. So it was a very, very fraught time. And what Gerald Ford brought to the White House was sort of a calm demeanor. And what Jimmy Carter brought to his candidacy, and full disclosure, I worked for Jimmy Carter's campaign in Virginia in 1976. Jimmy Carter brought, for want of a better word, normalcy.
I want to talk about that because as you said, you work for Carter, and you've said that a more decent individual you have yet to meet.
Correct.
The same could be said of Gerald Ford. He was a Washington insider, a congressman until he became a vice president, but he had a sense of duty to country and to the office of the presidency that he inherited. And they say he tried to do the right thing. So you work for Carter. Why were Americans willing to change out Gerald Ford, who was a traditional Republican, who was doing his best to right the ship, for this unknown, untested peanut farmer from Georgia?
For several reasons. First reason was that Jimmy Carter really had no involvement in the national government. So he was, quote, clean in terms of what was happening in Washington, D.C. The second reason, America was in the process of romanticizing the American South. We had these ABC governors. We had the Reuben Askew in Florida, Dale Bumpers in Arkansas, and Jimmy Carter in Georgia. And these three governors typified the transformation of the South from still fighting the Civil War and still supporting racial segregation to a region that was opening up to everyone, not only in terms of race, but also in terms of its economy. The South was growing faster than any other region in the country. So it was a poster child for what America could be, particularly in 1976 when we were celebrating the bicentennial.
There were something else at work on the other side of the aisle, John Dodd. John Dodd is with us from the Jesse Helms Center at Wingate University. And what's at work on the other side is the fact that Gerald Ford had competition in the Republican primary from Ronald Reagan, who almost won that primary and almost won at the convention until things settled out differently. Reagan represented the shift in Republican politics. I only have about a minute left in this segment, but do what you can here. Why were we ripe for that shift, do you think, John Dodd?
Well, I think it was a lot of the things that both Ben and David spoke to. There were, divisions. And I think from Senator Helms' viewpoint, he was very concerned about the shift in foreign policy. So, and he really worked with Reagan to promote that change in policy. And I think that was a major motivator.
I want to come back to that in a second, that shift in foreign policy. John Dodd, he's with us from the Jesse Helms Center at Wingate University. David Goldfield is a professor of history at UNC Charlotte. He's already alluded to it. He's also written the book Still Fighting the Civil War. And Ben Bradford is the creator and producer of Landslide, a podcast. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ben Bradford is with us. He's the creator and producer of a podcast called Landslide, a multi-part podcast which focuses on the 1976 presidential elections, which kind of set the tone for today's politics, if you listen to and believe what he says in that podcast. And we'll go through some of those things as we go through the hour. Dr. David Goldfield is also with us. Robert Lee Bailey, professor of history at UNC Charlotte, and John Dodd, professor emeritus or president emeritus of the Jesse Helms Center at Wingate University. We were talking, John, just before the break about why Americans, or particularly Republicans, seemed ripe for a Ronald Reagan candidacy over the very staid, conventional leadership of then-President Ford. And you brought up foreign policy. What was Ford doing with foreign policy that troubled Ronald Reagan and the people who believed in him?
Well, the instance that was brought up before by David about the China, the outreach to China, many people felt that was a great thing, but, you know, Reagan did not. And he was very much concerned about, he was still a Cold War warrior. That was still going on. And the anti-communism theme in our country was very strong. So there was a major, major thing.
So he took great issue with what was happening, and yet, not unlike Trump, who was taking great issue with what was happening in the country for his first run for president, here's the guy who was a Hollywood actor. Trump was a reality show host to most people. An actor who seemed vaguely dangerous to some folks, perhaps a little crazy, given some of the things that he talked about. He, like Biden and like Trump, was gaffe-prone and considered unserious. And although he did not win in 1976, John, he did win 4 years later. What happened in those intervening 4 years that made him acceptable?
Well, I do remind you, he was the governor of the largest state by population in our country. So he had a bit more of a resume than Donald Trump did for being president, I would say. But, you know, there was so much else going on in our country, obviously. That was, you're coming out of the civil rights movement and the change in the South with, you know, repeal of the Jim Crow laws. Then also the all the social issues, you know, the from abortion to prayer in schools, all these that had been percolating since the 50s. And I'm sure other guests can speak, you know, better to some of those issues. But I think with Helms, the foreign policy issue was very, very critical to his support of.
And we will talk about some of those issues as we go through this. Ben, you say that his move toward acceptability began after President Reagan won the North Carolina primary, which set the stage for later wins around the South and also set the stage for his being able to tap into the politics of grievance and backlash. Sounds familiar. We've heard that described, those descriptors being applied to Donald Trump. I had not heard it applied to Ronald Reagan before, or if so, I was unaware of it. Explain that.
Sure. So, first of all, it is an absolutely incredible race between Ford and Reagan. Ronald Reagan has lost 5 primaries in a row by the time he gets to North Carolina. And the writing is on the wall that he's done, that he's going to pack his bags. The campaign is broke. They're in debt. It's going to be over. And North Carolina is the hinge point, because if Reagan loses North Carolina, he is almost certainly out of the race. And if he's out of the race after having lost 5 times in a row, can he really then be the candidate in 1980? Most people that I've talked to from the Reagan campaign, political historians, et cetera, sort of point to this as the North Carolina as the turning point. Now, in terms of what Reagan stood for, so our second episode is very much focused on that and looking at how he was viewed in his time. And so it is absolutely true that anti-communism formed the core belief that I think a lot of Reagan's other ideology sort of wound around. Before he was a conservative Republican, he was a Democrat cutting ads for Harry Truman. But he was also still that core anti-communism was the key driver for him. However, as he became a candidate, and he was a very, very gifted candidate, he began to seize certain issues that spoke to the turmoil, the social turmoil of the time. And so you can hear in his 1966 race for governor, when he was a political neophyte, and where it did seem absolutely wild in a time pre-Jimmy Carter, pre-Ronald Reagan as governor, when candidates were expected to have experience. They were supposed to be, you know, I mean, Nixon had run for governor of California before Reagan. And Reagan seizes these certain issues. One of them is law and order. And another one is anger against college students who were protesting over the Vietnam War and what were called the free speech protests in California. And you can hear it at the time. You know, we have some news clips from the time going back and looking at the archival footage to see how was he viewed, where you can hear pollsters saying, you know, it's white backlash. Reagan opposed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. He opposed California's fair housing laws. And he did this in a way where, similar to how Barry Goldwater, the 1964 presidential candidate, had, where he said, you know, these are an expansion of government, federal overreach. But you look at who's voting for him and why they're voting for him. And this is, extends into 1976. And you can see that there's something else at play. And so what I mean by that, just very briefly, is that if you look at where voters are casting ballots for Ford, where Ford is winning and where Reagan is winning, Ford is winning in, at the time, what are really kind of the traditional Republican areas. So he's winning in the Midwest. He's winning in the Northeast. These are sort of the areas that have more Republicans in cities and suburbs and on farms. And Reagan is winning the South, which had traditionally been Democratic territory, right? The Dixiecrats. And Reagan is winning the South. And he is doing this because, while foreign policy absolutely is an issue, he is also the candidate of sort of social grievance of the time, saying we need to go back to the past. And you hear that very clearly in his speeches in North Carolina and in our upcoming episode. Which
and once again, that's a parallel to today, because we have a Republican presidential candidate who wants to go back to the past, who wants to cut alliances or ties, traditional foreign policy ties. He was losing. He lost the first five primaries, as you said, badly. And North Carolina was his last stand. This was going to end it when he came here if he didn't win. But he did win. And you say he won because he changed his message. Yes, he talked about all the things that you just referred to, but he had been talking elsewhere about budgets and cutting the budget and the size of government, kind of dry policy stuff that doesn't necessarily connect with people. But somehow he made a speech that became fodder for a campaign commercial that, believe it or not, focused on foreign policy, and it caught attention like wildfire.
I believe that our nation is in great danger, and that danger grows greater with each passing day. The sinister forces of totalitarianism are again on the march, while the democracies are wandering without aim.
So, Dr. Goldfield, that was obviously an oblique reference to President Ford's foreign policy at the time, but it created an eruption of interest in his candidacy here. True or not, it is striking to hear him warning us against totalitarianism, even as today's GOP candidate appears to embrace strongmen around the world. Can that progression be found anywhere within GOP political circles prior to Trump, this gravitation toward authoritarianism?
Yes, it certainly can. In 1992, Patrick Buchanan, a Republican who was an advisor to Richard Nixon in the early 1970s, gave a speech at the Republican National Convention, and he seconded the renomination of George H.W. Bush in 1992. And Buchanan laid out essentially what became the platform for the Tea Party. And by the way, Mike, Ronald Reagan really was the godfather of the Tea Party. The Tea Party didn't appear until 2010. But Ronald Reagan, particularly during that presidential campaign of 1976, where he came within a hair of defeating what essentially was an incumbent president, almost did it. Just let me quote what one Ford, Gerald Ford aide, said about Reagan in 1976. "We are in real danger of being out-organized by a small number of highly motivated right-wing nuts." Now, if you don't, this is Gerald Ford's folks speaking, but listen to Barry Goldwater, who was appalled by Ronald Reagan. And nobody is really in the Republican Party was much to the right of Barry Goldwater, as we all know. The former presidential candidate allowed that some of Reagan's aides were among, quote, "the most vicious people I have ever known." So when we look at American politics, we, of course, focus on the Tea Party and the emergence of Donald Trump. But actually, the roots of it are with Ronald Reagan in this 1976 presidential campaign.
So you mentioned this quote from the Ford campaign, that we are in danger of being out-organized by a small number of highly motivated right-wing nuts. The North Carolina primary was the moment in time when suddenly the Ford people saw him as a legitimate challenger, that he was no longer a joke, and much of the rest of the nation probably saw it that way too. And at a nearly deadlocked GOP convention later in the summer, it was a North Carolinian who became among the first to publicly endorse Reagan at that convention. And that North Carolinian was Jesse Helms.
"There is one distinguished leader who has stepped forward to talk sense courageously and honestly and forthrightly to the American people. You know who he is, and I invite you to join me in seconding his nomination, an able, courageous, dedicated American, Ronald Reagan."
John Dodd, you are the president emeritus of the Jesse Helms Center at Wingate University. Was that the moment, Jesse Helms' endorsement, that gave Ronald Reagan gravitas?
Well, I think it certainly played an important part, but it all started back in 1973, actually back in the early 60s. Senator Helms had gotten he was a manager and of the WRAL television and radio station in Raleigh, and Ronald Reagan was the host for General Electric Theater. And so Reagan would go around the country touring and such. And so they got to be good friends and over the years. And so in 1973, Helms at a lunch in LA actually said if Reagan would run, he would endorse him. Of course, this was before Ford was even president. And therefore, that was really the start of it. But you know, there's a lot of, you know, Ben has a lot of information about the actual guts of how the campaign went and all, but it was Helms who started then. And yes, it did give him gravitas, but truthfully, Reagan was campaigning for Helms when he first got elected and ran an ad for Jesse Helms in 1972.
Was it brave for him to put his name in the nomination at that convention, or was he a big enough political figure, Jesse Helms, that it didn't matter who he nominated? He was not going to be hurt by the nomination.
I don't think anyone would ever doubt Jesse Helms' courage. But you know, many doubted his wisdom at times, but he proved pretty wise in the end. You know, but no, it was not. I don't think it was it was something that he felt right with. And Helms, you know, he generally did what he thought was right.
And we have to remember that this is still a time when not everything was decided by the primaries. We still went to contested conventions. The Republican convention back then is certainly an example of that, and conventions that led to the nominations on the Democratic side just a few years earlier were also contested, and you didn't know who the candidate necessarily was going to be until the conventioners voted. But calling those who supported Ronald Reagan right-wing nuts sounds very much how traditionalists referred to Donald Trump in the first campaign. They thought he couldn't possibly win. What a joke this was. David, why do Republicans have trouble reading the tea leaves?
Well, we have two major parties. And when you have two major parties, you have factions within those parties. And reading the tea leaves becomes difficult because whenever you do read those tea leaves, you automatically, almost always, leave out factions within party. The Buchanan wing of the Republican Party had existed since the early 1970s and started to flower in the 1990s and culminated with the Tea Party movement in 2010. So they were part of the Republican Party, but what really changed the Republican Party was the issue of race, because you had this dramatic flip. When I was a kid in Memphis, Tennessee, Republicans were on the endangered species list. In fact, if you went in to vote in a Memphis election, you could not find the Republican Party on the ballot. It was the Democratic primary that really was the distinguishing election. So in terms of the South, the transformation of American politics really changed American politics for all time. And it brought a more conservative, race-conscious philosophy from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party, and that's where we stand today. But the roots, again, stem from the early 1970s.
Yeah, we've seen this flip-flop of party positions, what the Democrats used to stand for, the Republicans stand for today, and vice versa. We've also seen conversations about, oh my gosh, this is going to be the end of one party or the other. Their fate, their fortunes have sunk to the lowest ebb. And you point out, Ben, in your podcast Landslide, that by the time of the primaries in 76, support for the Republican Party nationally had dropped. This is an amazing number, had dropped to 18%. And some believe that the party might not survive its internal disputes. And I think that was before this Reagan-Ford contest really got underway in the primaries. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about that and how you approach looking at 1976 as a watershed election year. When our conversation continues, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a new podcast that recently dropped called Landslide. It's a multi-part podcast that WFAE played a tiny role in supporting, but Ben Bradford is the creator and producer of it. He's with us this morning from L.A. John Dodd is president emeritus of the Jesse Helms Center at Wingate University, and Dr. David Goldfield is a professor of history at UNC Charlotte. We were talking about how in 1976, prior to the presidential race, Ben, the Republican Party was in the cellar. 18% of the people in America supported them, which is a tiny number. It was also felt that if Ronald Reagan beat Gerald Ford in the primaries, it would signal the end of the Republican Party. Aside from the Watergate scandal, which drove a Republican president from office, why had they reached their low point?
So here's the thing that you have to understand when you think about political parties in the mid-1970s and going back before that, which is that they may have the same names, but in a lot of ways, they are just totally different entities in terms of the way that they operate. And so traditionally, both parties particularly for the last several decades before this time period we're talking about, had kind of drawn a big circle around the center of the American electorate and said, well, how do we get these guys? And of course, that's very different from what we see today, where the parties have sort of their bases and they kind of draw a center around their bases, and it doesn't reach all that far into the other party, does it? So they were really kind of competing for the same voters. And the thought was that if you had an ideological candidate who is dividing that center of the American electorate, using polarizing cultural and social issues to do that, that you're going to go down in flames. And there had been two recent very high profile examples of this. In 1964, Barry Goldwater had gotten the nomination, and he had run as a very conservative candidate, and he got crushed. And then just 4 years earlier, George McGovern had been the Democratic nominee, and he'd run this sort of insurgent campaign, as Goldwater had, although, you know, different styles under different rules. But he had gotten these liberal factions of the Democratic Party behind him, and then he got crushed. So the general consensus is you cannot win in this way. And so not only do you have Watergate, and voters are sort of looking at the Republican Party as maybe, you know, maybe getting off the bus, but you also have this empowered faction of conservatives who have been growing because the Southern Democrats have been coming over as Goldwater and then Nixon have used the Southern strategy, right, catering to anti-civil rights voters. And so now all of a sudden they're empowered. And the idea is, well, if they win, they could maybe win the Republican Party, but they're going to get crushed again.
It all sounds familiar. And once again, I believe you say in this podcast, because I haven't had a chance to listen to all of the episodes, but I believe you say at some point in this podcast is that this is the point where real political conservatives who had been out in the wilderness wandering around for a very long time had finally gotten enough critical mass to have an impact on where the party should go, the Republican Party should go. And they were tired of compromise. They didn't want to do it. They didn't want to build coalitions for those who did not share their views. Kind of like today. They didn't believe in the big tent. They wanted to have their people running the show with their policies and their values. Why did they move in that direction? It seems anti-intuitive.
Well, I mean, if you think that the parties, you know, don't represent your values, and you don't see your values represented in national politics, then, you know, in this case, these people made a move to try to make sure that their values were represented on the national stage in a way that they hadn't been. And so that quote about right-wing nuts, what that was referring to, the Gerald Ford memo from one of his staff members that's analyzing the campaign. It says, we're being out-organized by right-wing nuts. What was happening was really comprehensive, really sophisticated grassroots organizing. A lot of it happening through direct mail, and where the conservatives were fundraising. They were connecting people. They were saying, okay, there is a protest against textbooks in West Virginia. People are mad about that. We're going to go, we're going to help them organize. We're going to get names on our list of who is there. We're going to add them to our mailing list. We're going to go to protests against integrating schools in Boston by busing children. And we are going to add those names to our list, and we're going to help them organize. And they're creating a new coalition.
And John, I was going to ask you about this, because a lot of this, if Ben is right, and I think he probably is, a lot of this was happening in North Carolina, which helped lead to the Ronald Reagan victory in the primary here. A lot of this nascent media, which back then was a mimeograph machine and a distribution list. Today, it's multimedia and social media, etc. It began then. Was it just happenstance, or has this been part of the plan all along? Because it's very effective, and it's worked to change the nation in substantial ways.
Well, I think that certainly, I don't know if anyone would say it was a plan ahead of time, but people like Richard Viguerie perfected a direct mail strategy that allowed conservatives to raise money. And then people like that worked with Senator Helms, like Tom Ellis, who managed his the 76 campaign, who was very involved in the whole Reagan effort. So he was the one with the TV. He focused on the TV, and so those two things together came together, and you know, by 1980 campaign, though it was nationwide, and that's where the Republicans were able to, with Reagan at the top of the ticket, you know, take over the Senate as well.
And Dr. Goldfield, we live in a very different political world with very different realities and different rules, as a matter of fact. We have Citizens United, we have PACs, super PACs now that didn't exist back then. We have lots of dark money flooding the system. We have years and years and years of people learning how to communicate very effectively, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, with a single focused message hammered home every single day that the Democrats can't seem to duplicate. Does it matter anymore that you're not having a big tent party, that you are laser focused on what you want, no compromise, thank you very much, we'll win anyway? Has the stage been set for that?
No. To expand on that.
Please.
The presidential elections are still determined by the middle. What you do in a presidential campaign, you energize your base. My colleagues on the show have been very effective in talking about what the base is in each of the two major political parties. And once you've energized your base, then you appeal to this broad center. And there's still a broad center. And particularly in the suburbs. I think the 2024 presidential election will be decided by two things. One, a turnout of your base, and secondly, the direction of the suburban voters, particularly women suburban voters, since they vote in greater numbers than men do. And when we see the presidential campaign unfold, we're going to see the attraction of both candidates trying to get that middle while at the same time energizing their base to go out and vote, particularly in the 8 or 9 battleground states, because we already know the results in about 40 to 42 of the other states.
Yeah. Ben, I want to get back to the fact that this 1976 election kind of set the stage for everything that has followed since. Abortion became an issue in this campaign in 76. The content of textbooks and a parent's right to control what their children read and learn began to percolate through the system. There were demonstrations by parents. And schools closed. You report there was even sniper fire at a school bus over this issue. And then a new group called, drumroll please, the Heritage Foundation, which has since gone on to play a leading role in choosing Supreme Court justices, was just beginning to insert itself into our politics. In episode 3, you talk about a letter being produced and distributed nationally claiming that cannibalism, wife swapping, and the murder of infants was acceptable behavior being taught in the public schools, grade schools. None of that was true, just as many of the claims today about what's being taught in schools are also untrue. Was this the beginning then? This is the moment we can pinpoint the cultural divide that we're still living through today?
Well, a piece of trivia before I get into that, which is that the signer of that letter, who we do not mention in the third episode out Thursday, is Jesse Helms. So Jesse Helms signed that letter that says cannibalism, wife swapping, and murder of infants
John,
is acceptable behavior.
John, I feel an entrance moment for you in this conversation.
Well, I cannot. I'd have to go back into research. We'd have to research that and such. However, yeah. So I don't know exactly how to speak to that. If that, okay. we would have, Let me. I do want to say something. That's only fair.
Okay.
Not every letter that had Jesse Helms' name on that came from his political organization did he see before it went out. It's quite true. And in 1992, he broke with his political organization. And that was one of the major factors. And so that I can, you know, but
whether or not he
things
was
like that were happening or not, I don't know.
And whether or not he was, you know, whether or not he was schools. Directly, whether or not he was directly responsible, Ben, it still set the stage.
It speaks actually followed. To your point. And I think that example, that John was just saying, you know, that Helms may not, I mean, I don't know whether he signed it or not. I don't know whether he specifically looked at it. His signature is on it and it came from the National Conservative Political Action Committee, right? NCPAC, which was one of the very big direct mail or fundraising spenders in American politics, along with the North Carolina Congressional Club, which Helms controlled and Tom Ellis controlled. But the point is that the Heritage Foundation, which you mentioned, was also part of this string of organizations that were being founded. So the founder of the Heritage Organization was this kind of master organizer named Paul Weyrich. He also took control of an organization called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. He's often credited with naming the Moral Majority, the big organization run by Jerry Falwell of the Christian right. The Republican Study Committee, which is so impactful in among conservatives in the House. Weyrich was behind that. And he and Richard Viguerie and a few other people, Richard Viguerie was the big mastermind of direct mail that John mentioned, were very, very effective in creating organizations around single issues or a few issues and giving these organizations legitimacy. So founding the Heritage as a think tank that was different from a lot of think tanks at the time in that it was really focused on political action. And so all of that was being developed very intentionally to sort of organize a new movement of people.
I have about 2 minutes left, and Dr. David Goldfield, I don't want to not talk about Jimmy Carter, the other candidate in this race and the one that actually won the 1976 presidential race. He described himself as a conservative. He was leery of government. I want to know what made him attractive to Democrats at that time, given those political positions. Talk about that really quickly, if you can.
Jimmy Carter was not from Washington. That was the first thing. Secondly, his political philosophy was malleable. Let's put it that way. He flirted with segregation in the 1960s, and he was fairly close to Lester Maddox, the segregationist governor of Georgia. In fact, this succeeded him in the governor's chair. But he had a strong sense of decency. The first time I met him, he was talking with a group of black school children in the state house in Atlanta in a very conversational way and talking about the history of race in not only in Atlanta, but in Georgia as well. He seemed, I think Americans like their political candidates to be larger than life. And Jimmy Carter seemed smaller than life in some respects, which probably hurt him in his reelection campaign. But he was a very decent individual, and he changed the topic and talk of not only Georgia, but of the South from being an extremely race conscious region to being part of the American political process.
Pundits are saying that with the rise of Donald Trump, John, the era of Reagan is over. And in fact, Trump just said that he no longer wants traditional Republicans in the party. There's this stark contrast between Reagan and Trump, and a stark contrast between Trump and Biden. Reagan's outlook is one of an America that is the shining city on the hill. Trump is a very much darker outlook. How can Republicans who embraced Reagan now embrace Trump?
Well, I think it comes down to, for many of them, it comes down to the issues. And so often you'll talk to people and they'll say, well, I really liked his policies and I liked the way it was when he was president. And that, you know, but so there's not enough emphasis on those same issues that you would say that traditional Republicans were concerned with. Particularly things like the isolationist and go ahead.
I was going to say, Ben, I have 15 seconds. What do you hope people take away from this podcast?
Listen to Landslide. That's what I hope they take away from this conversation, Mike.
Shameless plug. Ben Bradford is the creator and producer of Landslide, a podcast you can get everywhere you get your podcast. Dr. David Goldfield from UNC Charlotte and John Dodd from the Jesse Helms Center.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.